listener production.
G'day, I'm Scott Phillips, the Chief Investment Officer of The Motley Fool and the host of, most importantly in this case, The Good Oil Podcast. Now, if you're not familiar with the phrase, giving someone the good oil is giving them the good stuff, the important stuff, and the real stuff. That's exactly what we're trying to do with this podcast. We're going to bring you conversation with entrepreneurs, executives, and experts. And speaking of which, today's guest is someone who has his finger well and truly on the pulse. He is a, quadruple threat, I think. He's a longtime academic, practitioner, author, television host, and a sought-after commentator. That's five by my count. He's a handful. Tim Harcourt, welcome to The Good Oil.
Oh, g'day, Scott. Great to be on the show.
Mate, thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. Now, let me. Most people will know of you or know you, but probably not the depth and breadth of your background, mate. So let me embarrass you slightly by reading your profile from the UTS website, where it says, Tim Harcourt is industry professor and chief economist at the Institute for Public Policy and Governance at UTS. His main interests are international trade, labour markets, climate innovation, and the economics of sports. I think we're going to have a good conversation. Before UTS, Tim was a professor of practicing economics at University of New South Wales. You held senior roles in public sector and private sector, including the Reserve Bank, the Fair Work Commission, ACTU, the Australian Trade Commission, and an economic advisor to three federal cabinet ministers and two state premiers. Plus, you are the self-described, the self-appointed, but also very reasonably, airport economist. You have the airporteconomist.com website, TV show, podcast on the Listener Network, of which we're obviously also a part. Mate, you've had a very, very long and storied career, and you're not even halfway done. But let me start with asking you, you're the airport economist. What does an airport economist do, mate, when the planes are grounded?
That's a good question, isn't it? Off to be the botany economist for a while.
Exactly.
It was a funny phrase, Scott, because when I was a chief economist at the ACTU, I was doing a lot of travelling, and I decided, you know, people don't want to spend, you know, dead time at airports doing nothing. So I said, well, I'm going to write about every country I visit. And I think I went to about 60 countries in 6 years, you know. And everyone said to me, well, what could you do? You only go to every country in the world from, you know, Kazakhstan to Mongolia to, you know, to Ecuador for 3 days. You only see the airport or in the hotel. And so that's where the phrase the airport economist came from. It sort of became a book, and, you know, we got it launched by, you know, Julia Gillard, and then the next one by Kevin Rudd. As soon as the Prime Minister launched my book, they sort of got knocked off, so no one else has offered to launch it since.
Funny.
And then David Kosh came to me and said, look, let's make it into a TV show. And then our good friends at Listener said, let's make it a podcast. So it sort of emerged, sort of grew up naturally, sort of like by evolution more than anything.
Nice, mate. I like it. Mate, 60 countries. I guess tell us what took you there, but maybe are there a couple that stand out for any particular reason, economic or otherwise?
Well, had a real funny trip one time, Scott, because I went to London with the Premier of South Australia, then Jay Weatherall. We went to a South Australian alumni function, and it was actually at the same venue at Festival Hall. There was Sacha Baron Cohen playing
himself.
The dictator,
okay.
You know, in one of his movies. And I yelled out to him, Your Excellency, I'm going to Kazakhstan next week. And he said, say hello to my friend Borat. You know, he's a journalist there. And then in the next fortnight, I did go to Kazakhstan and spoke at a conference. And the only other non-Kazakh speaker was Tony Blair.
Oh, wow.
And so I told him the whole story. And Tony Blair had lived in Adelaide as a kid, so he's very keen on Australia.
Okay.
And he said to me, let me get this straight. As the airport economist, you go all the way to London to meet Borat and all the way to Kazakhstan to see Tony Blair. You know, it's quite a – he was right. It's probably pretty – he probably gave me the best punchline of all. So
I love it, mate. I love it.
You go to unusual places, I think, is interesting. And also, I'm amazed, Scott, at how well Australians do. You know, they run mines in Mongolia. They run wine marketing in Argentina. You know, you come across a – Australian cricket team in Romania. You know, it's just despite the headlines we see when we get back home about Aussies being lazy and this, I think Australians are actually do very well on the world stage and are very good entrepreneurs and pretty good citizens mostly.
I like it, mate. I like the optimism. I like the positivity. Tell me about the airport. Firstly, for a plug, because the people at Listener will very much appreciate us talking about it, but also because I think our listeners would actually appreciate it as well. This podcast covers business and economics and finance and a whole lot of stuff. Tell us about your Airport Economist podcast, mate. What can listeners expect from the podcast?
Well, basically, if you want to learn about how to do business in Brazil or Singapore or India, what the airport podcast does is basically virtually flies you there, gives you a bit of a input into the economy there and the social transformations that's happening, and also potentially the business opportunities. So, you know, I noticed in Singapore that they had a huge supply of engineers and you know, superannuation consultants, but they didn't have many poets or dancers or creative people. And, you know, at one stage the Singapore government had posted a sort of government notice in their gazette saying, you know, to be creative, you must be creative on Saturday. It's compulsory between 9 and 12. You know, and funnily enough, it didn't really happen. So
exactly.
We got Bill Shakespeare over there to do some creativity in the Singapore government, and that sort of made a difference. And in the same way, you know, I've just noticed gaps in different markets around the world, and I've just sort of broadcast it. So I think for the general listener who wants to sort of know about the world, and I reckon – most of your listeners are pretty fascinated in the world economy and how it ticks and what the global issues are. And also, you know, for the entrepreneur there who's looking out for an opportunity. So it's really, you know, it's really globalisation, you know, through Australian eyes.
Mate, I normally start by asking people how they got into their careers, and I am fascinated about that. But I do assume, at least in part, it was because of your father, Jeff Harcourt, who is himself a very well-renowned economist and unfortunately passed away earlier this year, mate. He was a companion in the Order of Australia. He was given that award in 2018. And also, just to mention it, cites his eminent service to higher education as an academic economist and author, particularly in the fields of post-Keynesian economics, capital theory, and economic thought. So firstly, my condolences, our condolences on the passing of your father. And I assume that was a large part of what at least got you interested or aware of or maybe tempted into the field of economics.
Yeah, look, it was, and thank you very much. Yeah, my dad, you know, has just passed away, so it's very nice of you to pass on your condolences. And I've got to say, people have been wonderful. People that knew my dad or were taught by my dad, you know, 40, 50 years ago, have been in touch with me and the family. And even people that are I don't know very well have said that he's influenced them in some way. So it's been terrific to hear all those things. Yeah, look, I think he had an effect. I mean, my dad was, as you say, a post-Keynesian economist. He was he always used to say he was a very proud Australian patriot and a Cambridge economist by training. When I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, he was head of the anti-Vietnam War movement, worked a lot with Jim Cairns. He was an advisor to the Dunstan government. He was advisor to the Whitlam government and was actually quite frustrated, although he thought Gough did great things on ending conscription and social policy. He's very frustrated with the Whitlam government's economics policy. So he ended up advising Bill Hayden, and he formed the Adelaide Plan, which became the sort of forerunner to the Prices and Incomes Accord. And when I was a kid, this sounds a bit nerdy. When I was a kid, I wanted to be Bob Hawke. I wanted to work for the ACTU. So when I was 15, I went over to Melbourne from Adelaide and I walked into the ACTU and said, I want to work for the ACTU. And they said, well, listen, son, you've got to either get a trade and be head of a union or you've got to do a university degree. And I said, what should you do at uni? And they said, oh, probably law, economics. But to be honest with you, economics is more useful because we can always hire a barrister. And so I did economics, wanting to work for the ACTU, you know, and it actually happened, not when I was 15, but 25, when I was 25, 10 years later, I ended up my first job working for the ACTU for the very job that Bob Hawke did in the 1950s. And in fact, Bob Hawke was Prime Minister when I was working there. And my first week at work, he came in to the ACTU and he was introduced to me and he said, ah, young fella, I did that job, you know, in the 1950s. So it was sort of a bit of a thrill to meet Hawke, as effectively, you know, I was his successor. And he, you know, he was Prime Minister at the time. So that was, so I'd say, you know, my dad did have influenced me on the economics and the connections with politics. But I just had a nerdy sort of thing to want to work for the ACTU.
I love it. I've got to ask you a little bit more about that, mate. Why the AC, of all the options, of all the institutions, obviously there's some maybe some political thought as part of that. Maybe it's the role, maybe it's something else. Why the ACTU? Why not another organisation of equal or similar stature or style or approach?
Well, I did work for the Reserve Bank before that. I worked for Glenn Stevens, who later became the governor. I always remember one of my teachers in Adelaide said, well, you got a choice. You can, when I was tossing up between the RBA and the ACTU, and my lecturer said, well, you can go and, help the working class, or you can work for the ACTU. That was his, sort of that was his joke. But in all seriousness, the Prices and Incomes Accord was a pretty big time. Bill Keldy was very influential with Hawke and with Keating. Ralph Willis had been a former ACTU research officer. He was later the treasurer. So I think at that time, the 1980s, 1990s Australia, most of my lecturers like Barry Hughes were advising the Labor government. I think at that time the ACTU was very influential and very much a part of good public policy, particularly the opening up of the Australian economy to Asia and the rest of the world and ensuring that we had good wages and good superannuation and Medicare whilst we were engaging with the world. And I thought in some ways working for the ACTU was sort of my contribution to better working conditions and wages for Australian workers. And while I was at the ACTU, Bill Keldy said, well, mate, apart from the wage case, which is your bread and butter, what do you like? And I said, I like Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs and I like international trade. And he laughed and he said, oh, gee, I've been trying to get people to do both those issues for years because they're so low profile and I'll give you them both. And I did a lot on Aboriginal labour markets, which I enjoyed, and then did a lot in international trade, and that sort of became very important with the globalisation and the battle for Seattle. And my next job after the ACT was chief economist of Austrade, which was sort of helping companies to go international and become good exporters, which also meant, of course, Scott, they became good employers because most of the exporter community, they're the ones that pay better wages, better health and safety, better job security, better employment opportunity for women, for instance. So, I always thought the ACTU and the Austrade were two jobs that were just two different sides of the same coin really, for creating employment opportunity for Australia.
Tim, you mentioned a lot of capital L and lowercase L labour in that answer. Is there a sliding doors moment in which we might be talking to Treasurer Harcourt or Minister Harcourt or maybe even Prime Minister Harcourt? Was that ever on the agenda?
Well, it's interesting, Scott. A lot of people who did the role that I did, of course, went into Parliament. Hawke and Ralph Willis, Rob Jolly in Victoria. When I was at the ACTU, Bill Shorten was with Organising Works. Greg Combe was one of my bosses. So, that was very much part of it. My mum was a candidate. Okay. She ran in 1968 when she was pregnant with my younger sister, Rebecca. And this is 1968 in Adelaide.
Yeah.
And they said, my God, you're pregnant. What are you going to do? And she said, well, it's a bit late now, isn't it? And,
exactly.
and Chris Herford, the late Chris Herford, who passed away this year, he was a big supporter of her to run, pregnant and all, and so was Don Dunstan. And, in fact, at the high school I went to, Unley High, of course, produced Julie Gillard. So it wasn't unusual for mums to be on a ticket there.
But stopping with your mum, mate, you weren't tempted yourself?
Oh, I was once asked to run for a seat, Scott, they said to me, we've done some research on you. And I thought they're going to say, oh, you're a good economist or something important for an MP. But they said, oh, we've done some research on you. You're a little bit Jewish. You're half Jewish, but not too Jewish. So that's good for this seat. You're not Asian, but your kids are Asian. That's good for this seat. You're not gay, but you're pro-gay. That's good for this seat. That was their criteria.
Dear, dear. There you go.
And I thought, oh, dear, well, you really should get a gay Jewish lawyer with an Asian boyfriend, if that's the case. So
that's what you're looking for.
Someone approaches me and wants me to put my case to the local branches on merit, I'll do it. But
there you go. Not based on demographics.
Not on those other criteria.
Fair enough too. Mate, I want to go back to that period of time. We had Stephen Kokoulos on the podcast who sounds like he was in similar circles to you, at least at the same time around government, around the central bank, and Stephen's case in Treasury as well. That was, for some of our older listeners, they will know full well things like the Prices and Incomes Accord you just mentioned and the dramatic shift, the dramatic changes that were happening, not even only on the Labor side of politics, though the Labor government was in power through much of this, but globally, on the downside, potentially, Reaganomics, Thatcherism, but here locally, everything from the floating of the dollar, the Accord itself, so superannuation 10 years later, that 10-year period, 83 to 93, maybe arguably later, maybe to 96, maybe even to Howard's GST in 2001, but that was a remarkable year for policy. Strong policies, really good thinkers. It's always possibly rose-colored glasses, mate, but I kind of feel like that 20 years compared to the subsequent 20 years, the last 20's got not a patch on the thinking, the policy wonkiness in a really good way that was happening around that time. Do you have just specific reflections on that time, how it felt, what you went through, a sense of what it was like to be in and around government at that time?
It's a really good point, Scott. I mean, one thing that attracted me to the ACTU was, had a really good policy brain in that place, you know, particularly with the likes of, Bill Keelty and Simon Crean and later Greg Combe and so on. It wasn't just activism, it was a real, real serious policy place. It's interesting, about that period. I wrote a book on the Third Way, The Economics of the Third Way, and it was all about Tony Blair and centre-left politics like Clinton and Blair providing a third way between the left and the right.
Mm, mm.
And in some ways, what Tony Blair and Gordon Brown had done was borrowing from the blueprint of Bob Hawke and Paul Keating. And in fact, when I interviewed Paul Keating about the Third Way, he said the Third Way, in Australia, it was a bit like, there's a British book called The Joy of Sex that was a big seller around the world, but it wasn't a big seller in Australia. And Keating said it was like the Third Way. We were too busy doing it to write a book about it, you know what I mean? It wasn't, I think Keating said it wasn't the Third Way, it was the only way. So I think that centre-left project did very well, and I think to some degree John Howard, David Cameron sort of inherited it and didn't change it that much.
Yeah.
But now I think you're right. Now it's slogans and soundbites. Gough was good at a soundbite. He had its time and a good quip. But there was a lot of serious substance behind it all. It wasn't just going for the latest soundbite that you see in politics now. And I'm afraid probably social media hasn't really helped. I mean, I was writing a tribute to my dad about how my father had centre-left views, but he had really good friends on the right of politics and the right of economics. And it wasn't considered a big deal to have friends who thought differently than you. But now with Twitter and social media, people get very, very aggressive, don't they? I think even a nice fella like you occasionally cops it, Scott, over quite reasonably mild positions. And I think Kokoulis is right. It was a big time for big brains. And he's very modest, Stephen, but he was a big name when he was with Citibank. That was the emergence in the 90s, late 80s of, the great chief economists like the Kokoulis and Chris Caton, Don Stemmer.
That's right, yeah.
And having a large profile in the markets and being in some ways a communicator of good economic policy rather than just calling interest rates. And that was part of that period as well. I think you saw very high profile chief economists in Australia playing a role in good policy, particularly on international trade.
Mm. I am hopeful that I think it's social media to part, I think it's probably also partly focus groups. I am hopeful that at some future point we find conviction politicians of the like of Whitlam, Hawke, Keating, Howard, again, from either side of the spectrum in that case. But I do hope we end up with people who actually can kind of find a message and actually sell the message as being worthy in and of itself, rather than having to duck and weave around focus groups and polling. But I hope that's not a false hope. But I hold a preference for that to be the case.
I'll say this, Scott. One thing that was interesting when my father died, one of the first phone calls I got was from Josh Frydenberg.
Oh, nice.
I don't know him really well, but I think perhaps through the Melbourne Jewish community, some of my relatives, and he was very, very nice and had read everything my dad had written. And I think he said to me, my dad was a great economist, a great Australian, and as a Jewish Australian, he was really proud of him. And I thought that was a pretty decent thing. So I think, that's a sign of perhaps getting things back on kilter, particularly, given that Josh Frydenberg is the treasurer of Australia and maybe a future prime minister.
That's lovely, man, and you know, good on you for sharing that too, because it's important. I think it's important we humanise people. A really slight tangent, quickly, is Barnaby Joyce was writing the paper the other day about freeing Julian Assange.
Yeah, literally.
And, I don't necessarily get into that topic. Although feel free to if you want to, but it was more the point that, you know, that the cardboard cutout version of Barnaby we see in the media, and to some degree he promulgates himself because he is the consummate retail politician, as he's often described and described that way, because it's true. You know, his fellow travellers on the Julian Assange issues tend to be from the Greens and the left of the Labor Party and others.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Generally,
and it's just I think it was John Osterminer, as you mentioned, with Josh Frydenberg, and I'm sure there's others on the left as well. But just that idea of you can actually have, you know, different opinions, and you can have nuance, and things can be different, and not everyone lines up or needs to line up necessarily at each end of the field, and never the twain shall meet. There are times and topics and subjects and issues that hopefully can be discussed on policy grounds rather than purely on political ones.
Yeah, we sort of saying that Assange is mad as a snake but doesn't deserve to be locked up, I guess, was his...
That's pretty much it. And either way, I said, look, I don't like the guy, but I don't think he should be, you know, in jail. I think that was, again, that's important.
Yeah.
You know, you can have those views, and that's important. Mate, let's move on if we can. Let's talk current and then future. When I said to you, look, would you mind coming on the podcast? You graciously agreed, and I appreciate that. And then I said, well, is there anything you kind of, the top of mind, you're working on, or you want to talk about, or you got some interesting views on? And I love the soundbite. You said, how about we do the three C's? And much to my chagrin, I had to ask what those three C's were. And you said China, COVID, and climate change. So we might do those.
That's everything, isn't it?
That's a lot, right? Let's do it in that order, mate, because, I mean, yeah, they're all interlinked and there's other things besides. But let's start there. You are the airport economist. International trade has long been a specialisation of yours. I was going to say politics aside, but it's very, very hard to do that because of how much, and think about the most recent trade tariffs, there is so much that is arguably geopolitical more than trade, but trade seems to be, to my amateur eyes anyway, the bargaining chip or the way in which this kind of geopolitical policy is being pursued. At the same time, China itself is going through its own property issues with Evergrande slowly collapsing, hopefully in a controlled way. The Chinese economic growth story likely to moderate. I mean, still massive, massive dollar or yuan, you know, denominated growth, but the percentage growth numbers are falling as those numbers get larger. I don't even know what I'm going to ask, mate, other than how do you see China from an economist perspective, from someone who does spend a lot of time thinking about international trade? How is China sitting, and then how is Australia sitting relative to China?
Well, Scott, you know, your introduction to the question, I think, goes to the hub of it, doesn't it? In the sense that in Australia, there's a group of people like me who are sort of economists, business analysts. So we just see this great relationship that's made Australia prosperous and made, you know, the world a better place. And, you know, suddenly it all goes bad. And then sort of, you know, that's the sort of in the red corner. And then the blue corner, there are people who, for a living, you know, they do geopolitics and cybersecurity and
yep,
all the spook stuff.
Yep.
And they're really terrified about the rise of China and the South China Sea and a lot of the undermining of democratic institutions. So it's almost like there's two camps in Australia who have been in silos and not talking to each other.
Yeah, until now.
They probably do have to, right?
Exactly, yeah.
They probably do have to.
Yeah.
And I think if you go back to Gough Whitlam recognising China as, you know, opposition leader in effect, you know, he was going to be the first Labor Prime Minister since 1949, since Communist Revolution. So he took this huge risk going to Beijing. William McMahon said, yeah, the Chinese have played him like a trout. But little did McMahon know that Nixon and Kissinger, of course, were planning the same thing. You know, In interviews I did with Gough when he was alive and John Menninger, who works for him, and Stephen Fitzgerald, his first ambassador, comrade ambassador, you know, they were really clear to say Gough Whitlam was not a Chinophile, Sinophile or Sinophobe. He wasn't pro-China. He wasn't a China hater. He just thought, look, they're the coming place. We've got to engage with them. And I think pragmatically, from Hawke to Keating to Howard to now, you know, all the prime ministers have sort of been quite accommodating of China as a, you know, emerging power, always with simmering tensions, not quite as bad as they are now, but always simmering tensions. John Howard fell out with China and the LNG deal got them back on track. Hawke, of course, you know, shed tears for the students of Tiananmen, you know, and that could have ended our relationship, but China said that showed Hawke's inner love of China. Kevin Rudd speaking Mandarin, you thought that would be an in. Yeah. Not at all.
Right.
Like, they couldn't stand him. You know, it was actually Gillard that had quite good relationships with China without, you know, I don't think Julie had been to Chinatown, let alone China, before, you know, she went on the world stage.
Right,
so,
right.
So it's interesting how it's been ups and downs. And I've been doing this TV series called After the Pandemic, The Big Picture for Seven and for Ausbiz and Chinese TV. And, you know, we've interviewed all sorts of business leaders from Elizabeth Gaines, from Fortescue to former prime ministers like Malcolm Turnbull, to Cochlear, to David Koch himself as a Port Adelaide chairman going into China.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Just to get, you know, a feel for the relationship. And, yeah, all the business people want it. They want it back on track. And I guess there's two views. One is the extreme view is there's these business people who say just do whatever the Chinese say to you know, we need the money. And then there's people on the more hawkish side who say they're an authoritarian state. And you've really got to think about having all your eggs in that basket. So there must be, again, a third way or middle way between those two polar extremes. And, of course, in Australia, we always badmouth ourselves about how bad we are dealing with China or Japan or any other power. But China's having fights with everyone, you know, Czech Republic, Ecuador, Brazil, Japan, South Korea, EU, USA, Canada. UK, you know, there's China's got some issues with a lot of countries, not just Australia.
Mm. Their own internal story, mate. When you think about the Chinese growth story, you and I have been around long enough to remember every 5 or 6 years someone says this is the end of China. It hasn't yet been the case. I mean, it can't be eventually. But we're now having the same thing again. The property bubble is collapsing. The economic growth is slowing. The concerns that are held there for China's transition to what they want to be, which is a Western style economy driven by consumption largely rather than infrastructure spending and government support. They've done it at a remarkable rate of knots. I think, you know, politics aside, and we have to do that advisedly, but the pace at which they've gone from a pre-industrial revolution style economy, as you mentioned in 1949, effectively now, 70 years later, to, you know, on the verge of being the world's largest economy, still some work to do at a per-person GDP level, of course, but it's been a remarkable rise. When you look at that slowing growth number, you know, it must slow as the denominator gets bigger, but is there some sense that there is something needs to be fixed in China, something going wrong in China, or is this literally just the next phase of that inexorable rise?
Yeah, the big phase going from the nation of shippers to the nation of shoppers, isn't it?
You know, domestic, I haven't heard that one. That's good.
Domestic, you know, from export orientation to domestic consumption investment. Look, Scott, I mean, the most revealing story for me with China was when I first went there as a union official. You know, I went to a factory in Shenzhen and said, "Do you have workers' compensation in China?" And they, you know, got translated and they came back and they said, "No, if the workers break anything, they don't have to compensate us." You know, and then, yeah. 20 years later, I went to that same factory and they're talking about they were losing workers to offices, to air-conditioning offices, and they had to pay incentives, you know, piece rates to keep the workers, you know. So that said to me that there's always that threat of domestic wage and price inflation that really worries the Communist Party in China, and as well as you were pointing out, the fragility of their financial markets and the housing bubble. I think with a place like China, there's always this threat of overshooting, but the Communist Party is so controlling, they're always aware of it, and it's almost like they're ahead of the, you know, ahead of the game in terms of where the crisis is going to happen. So I think economically they can always manage things, but I think there's two issues they've got to watch. One is, you know, their wolf warrior diplomacy has done a lot of damage to them, and people said, oh, they're going to, you know, kill the chicken to warn the monkey with hurting Australia on trade. It's hurt China more than it's hurt Australia. It's damaged their credentials as a member of the WTO, as a, you know, serious economic leader, you know, in this new world order.
It's been very damaging to them. And secondly, something you're alluding to, the fragility of the political system, and you can't control people totally. You certainly can't try and control, students at campuses in Australia and do the same thing back home. So I think there's going to have to be political reform in China, and there's going to have to be a new maturity in their diplomacy, because it hasn't gone well. But in terms of economic management, I think they're pretty smart and they're pretty shrewd. So in some ways, the economic management of China from a macro point of view, I'd say that's a second order concern to China watchers in terms of their future economic performance.
Let's go to the others, or the second C, that's COVID. We're recording this in the middle of December, the 15th of December, actually, this recording is being made, and it is what's being called Freedom Day in New South Wales. I dislike the term immensely, but that's just to benchmark people who are listening to this subsequently. This is the day when masks are apparently going to come off and the unvaccinated can rejoin the rest of society, the rest of us who've been vaccinated. And yet, Omicron is around, mate. Our case numbers just today jumped by 50% from, 800 to 1,300 or something in New South Wales. I feel like we're on the cusp of something, and I don't want to date the podcast by trying to be too specific what's going on right now. But to whatever extent you want to talk about now or then or in the future, either way, COVID has really changed Australia's relationship with government in lots of different ways. And there are people who listen now who will say it's been terrible, they're authoritarian. There are others who will say it's been great, the government's loosened the purse strings and realised there are things that can be done when we need them to be done in a whole lot of different fiscal and monetary ways. Your reflections, mate, on COVID, the journey so far, and maybe to the extent you want to have a stab at the future, it's really changed the way governments have operated in Australia in a really fundamental sense.
No, you're right, Scott, isn't it? There was all this talk about globalisation and the end of the nation state and one world government. Well, that's not happened at all, has it? The nation state's come back.
Yeah.
Not just the nation state, but state governments.
Yes.
In this country. We thought, we only had a federation for the Sheffield Shield, but now you really start to see the importance of state governments. The biggest surprise for me, Scott, was the border closures internally. I thought we'd close up to the rest of the world for a time, which we did. Rocks and crops, mining, agriculture would still go, manufacturing would still go. We'd be really hard on tourism and international education, which it has been. Mm. The big shock for me was the domestic border closures.
Yeah.
I thought domestic tourism was going to pick up on the slack where international went down, but that's been the big surprise. And the other thing, Scott, is that this whole debt and deficit monster's been
disaster.
Killed, hasn't it? It's gone. This fetish that we had, particularly under the Abbott hockey treasurership, Abbott was prime minister, that's now gone. There's no back and black, slogans anymore. So in some ways, we have seen, return to reasonably sensible economics where you do have to intervene like you did with the GFC when you went, go hard, go early, go household. So that's a positive. One thing that concerns me, I wouldn't go so far as to say authoritarian governments, but the civil liberties, union's been pretty quiet. The libertarians have been pretty quiet. This idea that you just listen to scientists and public health experts and you just do whatever they say, that happened for parts of the pandemic. Well, so I think there's risk and judgment in all these calls. And certainly in New South Wales, Dominic Perrottet has sort of made the balancing of risk and being able to have economic activity occur. He's made more judgment on that sort of thing, whilst instead of standing behind your chief health officer and just following purely health advice, I thought we're sort of over some of that high water mark, it seems. And that's probably welcome because you can't have 100% risk aversion, or otherwise nothing's ever going to happen again, you know.
I used the term earlier in the pandemic that COVID policy is not health policy and health policy is not public policy.
Yeah.
I have wondered during the pandemic whether they should be paying more attention to the health experts and other times when it may have been more appropriate to be balanced. But I think the criticism of governments around the country of not following the health advice, it can't ever be the case that we only listen to one department when it comes to the impact, because this was a multifaceted impact. There were health implications, arguably most important, particularly in the scarier times of the pandemic. And frankly, with the exponential curve currently, we're still going to see what happens next. But at some points, it's like, guys, this is panic stations. We've got to listen to the health guys. At other times, you know, government should, by definition, be taking advice from everybody and saying, on balance, here's what we think is best for the population, not just here is best for COVID or health or any other thing, but overall, the society made up of all those different components.
Yeah, some of it seemed like, using a jackhammer to break a walnut, just seemed over the top at times. And one good thing about economists is that they can point out possible adverse, unintended consequences of policies, even when they've got good intentions at heart, and the importance of balance and opportunity costs and the fact that most public policy is having good judgment.
Yeah. I do wonder, this is going to be a massive tangent, mate, but you mentioned economists, and I think it's important because I've been critical of classical economics as being too model-centric. I think the advent of behavioural economics, the adoption of and the promotion of behavioural economics, just recognising we're in a messy world where things don't operate the way the models say they should, or where you don't just say, well, excluding that, it would be fine. you have to live in the real world. So I think that's been a real positive in terms of the change to...
I think you're right. I think it's been good that economists have got involved with the debate in a sensible way, because otherwise the scientists would... say everything, without any economic consequences. So I think that's been good. And also economics is slowly getting away from the mathematical modelling, driven, which was all the rage, about the time when
econometrics.
I was doing it. And there's a role for technique, but it was too dominant at one stage. I think to some degree, the fall of the Berlin Wall, when you had a lot of unemployed, Russian and East European mathematicians and engineers, they all had to find jobs and they all went into economics and they made it much more technique and modelling focused, where, as you say, it's a social science and life's messy and there's political consequences.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It occurs to me, known as the dismal science once upon a time, I think economics these days, and in a really good way, a really positive way, can I argue that it's broadly better defined as applied psychology? Is that too wishy-washy a term? How do we kind of...
I think applied psychology is one of the ingredients, I think so.
Let's go to climate change, the other C. This one we get a bonus C because there's two in climate change, of course. You have been involved in the thinking and policy creation and commentary around climate change. This is one, and like other things we've talked about through this podcast, the politicization, the kind of the us and themness of some of this stuff is beyond me. When 98-something% of politicians say we should do something, politicians say we should do something about climate change, and we yet manage to find a set of policies where we kind of put off, delay, whatever. I'm happy to nail my colours to the proverbial mast and say that climate change is real and we should do something about it, and we probably should do something about it reasonably quickly. From an economist's perspective, mate, and feel free to talk as an individual, of course, as well, I think it's too easy to say, well, of course, if we do this, there's lots of jobs created, there's some magic pudding, there's some pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and if we do the feel-good stuff, then all these jobs are going to materialise all of a sudden, and, wow, look at the value we've created. Even as someone who believes in strong action on climate change, even if it costs us, I find that a little too Pollyanna. But am I being too cynical, mate? Is there some hidden jobs boom that doesn't cost anything that's all of a sudden all pure upside, or is there more nuance in the conversation?
Yeah, well, I've just done this series, the Airport Economist Climate Innovation series with DFAT. Let's put the green back in the green and gold sort of thing. And what I did was I was getting sick of all the Paris targets and countries like Ireland and New Zealand saying, pledging to get out of coal when they don't export coal anyway, this sort of stuff. And I wanted to have a look at companies that were actually doing good things. So, we had a look at companies that were providing building materials as they recovered from the bushfires, and we had a look at Titium up in Queensland that does electric batteries. We had a look at Whyalla. And I was just finding, gee, there's actually a lot of Australian companies already doing things in the climate innovation space. They don't get reported because people want to report Glasgow and Paris and
that's right,
awful things, you know, and they don't want to report real progress. Ultimately, I think, you know, mankind will find a way, as it always does, because it adapts to different circumstances with the right, you know, with the right incentives. And I actually do think that you'd be really careful with the transition. You'd be very, very careful of unintended consequences. And the people calling for Australia to stop all coal tomorrow are not realistic, and they're going to cause real difficulties in places like Russia and China and Indonesia that are going to go full pelt, you know, and the same way you see the European Union, you know, making various platitudes at Glasgow, but, you know, doing the deal with Russia over the gas. So I actually would be in favour of your Nicholas Stern sort of approach to climate change. He wrote that big report for Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, and that's, you know, it's the biggest externality the world's ever seen.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't know how severe it is, but let's just take out a bit of insurance.
Yeah, I like that, mate. I like that. As an economist, you mentioned the word incentives, and there a large amount of modern economics, probably it always should have been, but is now devoted to the idea of incentives, and we get back to that behavioural psychology, behavioural economics school of thought. Again, I'll make a statement. You can respond to it or feel free to avoid it. The idea of emissions trading is kind of economically, classically attractive because there's a mechanism and there's all that sort of stuff. But we've seen with water rights and other things that market. I'm a massive fan of well-regulated open markets, not totally free markets, but well-regulated open markets. In this case, it feels like a set of infrastructure that would make a lot of money for the market operators and those who could game the system, rather than a very simple carbon tax, which I know is horribly politically impossible. But it just strikes me that trying to create a fun mechanism for doing this stuff versus just saying, you know what, guys, you're now going to have to pay $40 a ton or $80 a ton or whatever the right number is, and it'll escalate over time. Your thoughts as an economist on the idea of a trading system of some description rather than just a straight out price signal like a tax or something else?
Extraordinary, wasn't it? You had a government of the left trying to use a market solution.
That's
and a
right.
Party of the right.
Getting rid of it, exactly.
Opposing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the big mistake was called a carbon tax,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if they'd approached it as, you know, this is an international development contribution, here's what Australia's going to contribute,
yeah,
that would have been better than a new tax. So a lot of that's to do with language. With trading, yeah, you've got to set a price because, you know, got to know, you know, you've got to get people to respond to prices, as you say, with behavioral economics. But I think people is going to game the system no matter how well you design it. And at least they'll be speculating against each other. I mean, even the float of the dollar, you know, as Keating said, better the speculators speculate against the speculators, against the government.
Yeah,
and it's probably the same principle with trading.
Good point. I there was a plan proposed for Canada, which I quite like, and I'd, again, as an economist, be keen to get your thoughts on this. I don't know if it's actually policy. It's been a while since I heard about it, but the concept was a carbon dividend, where every household or every adult, whichever way you design it, was given an amount of money, which would offset the increase in prices on the back of a carbon tax. And they could actually keep, effectively almost like a, you know, household level ETS, they could keep whatever savings they made by using less electricity. So if you get every household got, pick a number, $1,500 a year, but your bills went up by $1,500 a year in terms of the same usage, then you'd at least be covered for that. But if you could save $100 or $200 or $300 by having more energy efficient appliances or being careful what you used or choosing renewable energy or something else, you would actually get to keep those savings. Just struck me as a really, really simple solution where people actually get some money for this. So it's not so much a tax. It was proposed as a carbon dividend. I quite like that concept. Has that got legs in your mind, mate? Is it too simple? Is it too?
It's quite appealing. It's a bit like the VB ad, isn't it, for solar panels? yeah, I mean, it's people suggested this in education where they've suggested give everyone a contribution to childcare, and they can either take the money, spend it on a childcare centre, spend it on a nanny, or keep it and look after their own kids.
Right.
You know, it's similar because it, you know, provides
in
a sense a transparent right to every household. It's probably got to be part of the solution. I don't think it can be, you know, how many trees you planted. I mean, I think you do have to in some way impact the hip pocket of households and companies to make it work. I think you're right, Scott. Mm.
Mate, Tom, you've been very generous with your time. I'm going to finish, if I can, with our four regular questions. Let's start with, I don't know if you're a streamer, I don't know if you're a Netflix fan, a podcast listener, hopefully you make your podcast, so you're probably busy doing that, making your own TV shows. But to the extent you have some time to yourself, what are you watching, listening to, enjoying at the moment, Tim?
Work-wise or pleasure?
Pleasure. Or both. If you enjoy your work, I'm sure, so whatever you want to go with it, mate.
Oh, well, I'm a big fan of, conversational type podcasts on economics and history and sport. I'm doing one on the economics of sport, footynomics that's coming up. So I like quite interested in that aspect of sports, not just on field stuff. I don't watch a lot of free to air TV now, mainly sport, I'd say, and occasionally some news, but most of my news is probably digital. When you can get the Financial Times and, top writers in the world like a Martin Wolf or something online, you tend to go to that. Occasionally I watch the Channel 9 news, Scott, if you're on, but that's the only reason.
You're a good man too. The late news, of course. I don't make the main bulletin yet, but I do try and contribute to the late news. You're very kind.
Best time to watch it.
Exactly. Thank you, mate. Hey, you're an economist, so you watch trends for a living, at least in part of your job. What trends are you watching? What's most fascinating you at the moment?
Oh, well, I'm interested, obviously, in the geopolitics, as you are. So I try and read as much foreign policy type stuff as I can, because I know they've got economic implications. I quite like. I'm a bit of a sucker for demographics, particularly in the labour market. Immigration. Different regional type movements. I like all that sort of stuff. In terms of international stuff, I tend to go for opinion makers, Tim Harford, the Undercover Economist, Martin Wolf, in the FT. I've gone off opinion in Australia a bit. I love Ross Gittins in the Herald, but a lot of opinion, particularly on politics, I don't know. Don't know where the value is. It's just a recent thing. I still always watch Insiders as a religion, when Barry Cassidy used to run it. But some of the political analysis in Australia I've found a bit wanting at the moment, to be honest. So I haven't watched that as much as I used to.
Fair enough. Mate, you've been a long-standing economist of note. You have a long history. What advice would you give someone who was your age, 15 years old, they walked into your office rather than the ACTU and said, Tim, I want a career in economics. What advice would you give them?
Yeah, well, my daughter got 91 in economics, she's going to do criminology, so she's really taking my advice. Not watching all that CSI. I actually have had some young people give me a call, come and see me. And I think you've got to have good solid sort of policy training and reasonable analytics, but not super econometrics, but just to be pretty comfortable with data and comfortable with the basic maths, be a good writer. And I think you've got to pick a couple of policy areas you really like. Like I loved labour markets and wages and also trade. So I think if your thing is, the environment or it might be transport. I think pick a couple of really good practical areas. I work at the Institute for Public Policy and Governance at UTS, and we do amazing projects. One month we'll be doing the economics of sport. The next one we'll be doing Aboriginal art. Next time we're doing local government. So I think there's some really great jobs for public policy economists, and particularly post-COVID and with climate. I think, health economics is going to really, really, really boom, particularly how we manage pandemics. So I think someone who's got a bit of a health policy background, I suspect there'll be a lot of employment for economists like that. When I finished, Keating had just deregulated the financial markets, so there were some great jobs like, Kakulis did in the financial markets. Now I think they're going to exist, but there's also going to be some pretty fascinating jobs in health economics and in the environment.
I like it. I like it a lot. Mate, last question. I'm an optimist by nature. I sense you are as well. So my favourite question of the lot is always, what are you optimistic about?
I'm always optimistic about Australia because when it comes to, you know, drought, depression, bushfires, major economic challenges, we seem to do quite well with a reasonably optimistic nature. And the fact that everyone's a bit of a battler, you know, whether you're Indigenous, whether you're a working class migrant, whether you were a convict, everyone who's come to this country has come to Australia with not a lot. And they've all had a bit of get up and go. And I think that gets into our nature a bit. So that's why I tend to be a bit of a sunny optimist because of the nation I was brought up in. One really lovely thing about my job, particularly the travelling aspect, was I would have been to almost every country that I'd meet someone in Australia from there, you know. So I'll meet someone from Peru or Mongolia and they'll say, oh, I'm from Peru, have you been there? And I can say yes. And then they can sort of wax lyrical about Peruvians in Australia. So I think that's one thing that injects my optimism. Plus it's sometimes it's good product differentiation, Scott. You know, if everyone in the media is a bit negative, you go positive, you get a bit of a run, don't you?
You do, and justifiably so. Tim, thank you for being so generous, spending some time with us on The Good Oil. If you want to follow Tim Harcourt and you're on Twitter, jump onto Twitter, at Tim Harcourt is his Twitter handle. Jump onto the Airport Economist podcast as well and the upcoming Footynomics one you just mentioned. So looking forward to that one coming out. I'm a footy fan myself, mate, so that's going to be close to my heart as well. Tim, thank you for joining us on The Good Oil.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
This podcast is hosted by me, Scott Phillips. It's produced excellently by Beth Gibson and audio imaged brilliantly by Link Kelly. Listener.